Welcome to Tentpole Trauma, the podcast where we look at movies that came with hype and high hopes, but left with crushing disappointment, either critically, at the box office, or both. Freed from the weight of expectations, we seek to examine these underperformers under a new light, parsing through the good, the bad, and everything in between with the hopes of gaining a better understanding as to why they failed to find their audience. Warning, there will be spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie that we're discussing today, I suggest you stop the podcast and go watch it. Then when you come back and listen, you'll get more out of the discussion. On this episode, we discuss Heaven's Gate. Okay, I am Sebastian and I'm here with Troy.
Hello.
This episode, we are discussing Heaven's Gate, one of the most infamous bombs in movie history. It's one of those movies that we just had to get around to one of these days in Tentpole Trauma, and I want to thank you, Troy, for taking the bullet on this one, so to speak.
You're welcome. Yeah, this was a rough ride. For sure.
It's definitely a bit of a rough ride, but let's talk a little bit about the legend of Heaven's Gate before we talk about the movie itself. Like, as I've stated, this movie was like a huge box office bomb. And if you were alive and a moviegoer in the early 80s, you knew the name of this movie because it was just synonymous with the concept of a box office bomb. It had come out, gotten really bad reviews. It had this crazy release schedule where they released the movie in its original running length, which is a whopping 3 hours and 40 minutes. And they released it in November, and it did so badly that they pulled it after a week. And then 6 months later, the director, Michael Cimino, recut it and put it back out as like a 2 hour and 40 minutes movie in April, and it still bombed even worse then and got even worse reviews. So it's a real weird anomaly in the history of film.
Did you actually, in the 80s, did you remember hearing about it when you were a kid?
Oh yeah, definitely.
I did not. I never heard about this until I studied film. In college, this was like a thing that would come up.
Well, I was a real nerdy kid, and I used to read the Boston Phoenix magazine and read all the reviews of movies. So I was paying attention to this stuff. And I remember the movie coming out. I mean, I didn't see it. In fact, I have not seen the movie until last night in preparation for this podcast.
And you watched it in a single viewing?
Yes.
Yeah, not me, man. It took me 3 days at least to watch this movie.
That might be the best way to take in this movie.
I had always thought that I had seen this movie. So that was the other thing, is that I'd known about this movie for, 25 years or something. I'd read about it. I had seen stills of it. I'd heard about it. But I was getting this, when you asked to do this episode, I was like, oh yeah, that movie, I have to watch that again. But I was always getting it mixed up with Days of Heaven,
right?
Which I really like.
Yes.
Which is it's a great movie, but it's another long epic movie from that era, shot during the magic hour and all that. So I had thought in my mind, it was like, oh yeah, Heaven's Gate. It's time to watch that one again. But I'd never seen it before.
It also, unfortunately, is associated, just because of the name, with the Heaven's Gate death cult.
That's right. If you try to Google it, that's the first thing that comes up, as the death cult.
Right. There's no correlation that I'm aware of. It's just, they're two different things that were called Heaven's Gate. I mean, you know, Heaven's Gate is just a reference to the pearly gates of heaven or whatnot. And the Hail Bop death cult called themselves Heaven's Gate. They were the ones who were going to take a ride on a comet. And so they all drank poison Kool-Aid or whatever and killed themselves. And they were found wearing like Nike sneakers and bunk beds and stuff. It was a pretty gruesome, lurid tale from the mid-90s. But it has nothing to do with this movie, but both things that live in infamy with the name Heaven's Gate attached to them.
And like I said, you do have to kind of weed through the Hail Bop cult to get to this film when you Google it online. So, but yeah, I know way more about the story of Heaven's Gate and call it the end of the new Hollywood era of the studio basically, it's that there was a director-driven era of studio filmmaking where budgets and egos and cocaine were getting enormously out of hand.
Well, and it's funny too, because when you watch this movie, I really feel you can feel that in the movie. Like, the movie that keeps coming to mind with so many scenes in this movie for me is The Godfather. Like, this feels like Michael Cimino was going to make his The Godfather.
Yeah.
And The Godfather is arguably the movie that really kicks off the director-driven era.
It is, definitely. Like, that's actually kind of written up as Coppola made The Godfather. It was such a big hit, and it made Coppola a celebrity as a director. It was symbiotic, the director's face with the picture, and then that kind of created this era where studios would take these celebrity directors and then start associating budgets with them and pairing them as a release, almost like a rock star releasing an album.
And this director, Michael Cimino, he kind of came onto the scene with this movie Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, which I've been meaning to see and I haven't. But the thing that really made him was The Deer Hunter, which was released in 1978. He won Best Picture for that. He won Best Director for that. And, you know, it was one of the first movies to really tackle Vietnam. You know, for a long time during the Vietnam War, nobody wanted to touch it. And then the Deer Hunter came out and Apocalypse Now came out, and then Vietnam became kind of a hot topic for movies, but The Deer Hunter gets credited for really kind of breaking that barrier. It was widely celebrated. I remember as a kid even hearing about The Deer Hunter. I knew there was a Russian roulette scene with Christopher Walken in it that was really upsetting and famous or whatever. Have you seen any of Michael Cimino's films?
I've seen The Deer Hunter. I love The Deer Hunter. I really like that film. But I have not seen Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. And I always thought Thunderbolt and Lightfoot was a Dirty Harry movie.
Yeah.
It's a Clint Eastwood movie, but I thought that was just in the groupings of one of the Dirty Harry movies. It's not, though, right? Or is
no.
It similar? It has nothing to do with him as a cop or anything.
No, it's kind of a buddy crime movie with him and okay. Jeff Bridges, I believe.
I want to see it now because that one was received well. Like I said, I love The Deer Hunter. Seeing the progression of his films and reading a lot about Heaven's Gate, I can kind of see where things went off the rails and why I have a different reception of Heaven's Gate, which I'll get into. But yeah, I'm interested in seeing his other work prior to The Deer Hunter.
Well, apparently the success of The Deer Hunter really went to his head because the production of this film was a nightmare. It was originally budgeted at $11 million. It came in ultimately at $44 million. So it went crazy over budget. And that is mostly attributed to just like he apparently would do like 50 takes of every take. He was pulling some Kubrickian shit. Everybody referred to him as the Ayatollah on the set.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories of all kinds of things that were done without any kind of oversight on the production. Not only did this guy get like a blank check and they would just give him money whenever he asked for more, but also they were kind of letting him do anything he wanted and even kind of avoiding legal parameters. Like there was reports of animal cruelty.
That's right, yeah.
Cruelty towards the actors on the sets. You can do deep research into finding out how awful this production was. You mentioned like Kubrickian. It's worth noting that Kubrick also had a huge hit in 1980. So 1980 is kind of an interesting year to look at all the other things that were happening with these celebrity directors, because Spielberg had a movie that came out that was a bomb.
1941.
Yeah, 1941. Scorsese's Raging Bull actually was a bomb, believe it or not. So, yeah, which I didn't know. I never knew that, but it was not received well. And he was kind of devastated after the release of Raging Bull. Woody Allen had a movie. So there were all these directors, and if you look at the budgets for each of these movies, they're pretty huge, but Heaven's Gate by far is the highest budget movie in production from that year. It's $44 million. This is the same year that Empire Strikes Back came out, which had a budget of
like 18 million or something.
Yeah, it was like, it was so low compared to these other movies that were, there's so many other movies that were coming out that was way above Empire Strikes Back. 1941, which is the Spielberg movie that nobody remembers, that's $30 million.
I saw that in the theater.
Really?
Yes.
Flash Gordon, which we've covered on this, that's $40
million. Wow.
Popeye was $20 million. So Robert Altman also, he had a huge fail during this era too, which he had to end up selling his production company because of Popeye.
Well, yeah, this was such a bomb that it nearly bankrupted MGM.
Well, no. It was United Artists, and then I think MGM absorbed United Artists.
Oh, okay.
Is what happened with Heaven's Gate. But it is a culmination of Heaven's Gate definitely is the one that takes the blame. It's the scapegoat.
Right.
But there was a culmination of things that were happening kind of a little bit starting in 79, but definitely like hit in 1980. Studios were already kind of getting cold feet and things were getting out of control, and execs were already talking like, what are we going to do about this problem? But then when Heaven's Gate failed miserably and it really kind of made United Artists collapse as a studio. Its library had to be completely absorbed by MGM. MGM had to pay, I think, an enormous money for all their losses. It was a huge deal. The title of your podcast, Tentpole Trauma, this really was like the epicenter of like an earthquake that happened in the studio system.
It's funny, last night while I was struggling to get through this movie, I kept getting notifications of all the Super Bowl commercials, of all the tentpole movies that are coming out, like, this year, and it's such a wild contrast to like that this movie was considered to be a huge tentpole movie. Like, considering now what's a tentpole movie, it's like crazy.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Like, what changed kind of overnight here? So prior to that, like you mentioned, The Godfather sort of started this trend, and it was really artistically driven, egocentric pet projects for these directors that were super influenced by foreign cinema. Like, these guys kind of grew up on looking at Bergman films, and they wanted to be part of the French New Wave. And, you know, those were their influences. And for some reason or another, these depressing dramas were funded by studios, and some of them worked, like The Deer Hunter, hugely successful.
Yeah.
A lot of them were not working, but the budgets kept increasing.
Yes.
But people like Coppola, I mean, even Spielberg, we've talked about Sorcerer.
Yep.
That was just a couple of years prior to this, with Friedkin. All these guys wanted to make these dramas. And if you look at what won Best Picture in 1980, it's Ordinary People, which is super depressing. The other thing that was happening parallel to these really artsy, dramatic movies that were influenced by foreign and French films was the rise of Star Wars.
Right.
So you had a lot of copycats that kind of came out in 79. You started to see your other Star Wars copycats coming out. But what the movies that were wildly successful suddenly were genre movies. So Empire Strikes Back, you know, The Shining was a hit. What are some of the other hits in the 80s? Like the Blues Brothers was a hit. So these dramas suddenly were hemorrhaging money and losing so much money that they quickly did an about face. And it became kind of right after 1980, it became franchise, genre movies, science fiction, and adventure films, like bankable, notable, and sequels started. You know, this is when the era of sequels, sure bets, started to happen.
Right, because they sort of realized that the adult market would only sustain so much at the box office, and spending like a lot of money on these dramas that were predominantly appealing to people over the age of 30.
Yeah.
What they did was they figured out the sweet spot of the demographic was like 18 to 24. Like, you hear a lot of talk about the 18 to 24 demographic. And I think that either in the 70s, people from 18 to 24 had more adult taste in movies, or they just weren't hitting that kind of younger market who wanted to see more genre stuff.
Well, it's not like there weren't the drive-in movies happening at the same time. There was a lot of, you know, crappy movies that teenagers would go see, but no money was spent on those.
Right.
All the money that was going into huge productions were these dramas. Even Star Wars was a low-budget movie.
Yeah.
So if a studio was backing anything, stuff for teenagers, that was always, I'm trying to think of, you know, surfing movies, or you would have stuff that teenagers were into in the 70s. You'd have a slew of science fiction or horror films, which is like, you know, arguably some of the best of its era. But these were all low budget movies or independent movies at that time.
What a lot of these movies were also doing, I think, is they were borrowing from the big spectacle films of the 50s and the 60s.
Like Lawrence of Arabia or
something. Right. Those tended to be more historical dramas, and that's why they'd be so expensive, because they are putting all this money into recreating time periods and whatnot. And those were sort of your big budget movies back then. But I think what happened is these directors got these bloated egos, and so they wanted to make these movies that were essentially dramas into sort of epics, which this movie is definitely guilty of. But like, that's kind of the formula for The Godfather. You know what I mean? The Godfather is about a family, but it's done on this grand scale. You know, it's like a period piece, and it takes place over like many years, like several decades. So you're getting all like a bunch of different periods. And I think that mentality sort of seeped into these guys, and they were like, well, I'm going to make my epic.
Right.
Even though really what they were suited to doing was making more dramas, you know, like they should have been making more low budget personal dramas.
Right.
And I think one of the big failures of this movie, the drama is a failure. I think that is what's the problem here.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you on that. You can see a vacuum in what should have been the driving force of the movie, which is really just about like two people. It's kind of like, when you boil it down,
it's a friggin' love triangle. This is like Twilight.
It is not. Just to paint a picture of what this movie, when you first put it on, they recreated a town, like not just a town, but like a small city. Like they built smokestacks and electrical lines and trains coming through. There's like hundreds of extras in here, all wearing the most articulate costumes, and you look at it, and it's the most believable recreation of a period piece I've ever seen. It's amazing in the just sheer budget of production.
The production design is fantastic. And like, it's like you're saying, you really feel like you've been transported to this time of the late 1800s. I mean, it looks amazing.
Yeah.
Let's get into the movie.
Yeah, I put this on. I immediately realized I'd never seen this before. And so I kind of came in with the attitude, was like, okay, I'm going to finally watch this movie that has this stigma to it and this smear, this stain. I'm going to give it a completely open mind. And I honestly love epics. Like, give me a movie with an intermission in there, I'm on board. Like, I love epics.
Me too.
And when I first saw a couple of the landscapes of the images in here, it looked beautiful. It was a little overly smoked, which is a huge, you know, device in the 80s to just smoke the shit out of your set so it looks like you're shooting through a sock. But
yeah, the cinematographer was Vilmos Zsigmond. I don't really know too much about him.
He's pretty huge.
I mean, I assumed he was a big cinematographer of the time, for
He's
sure.
He's a big deal.
That was very in vogue in the late 70s, that kind of Adrian Lyne almost.
Yeah, just so you see like rays of light coming through windows, and it looks like somebody had stopped the flu in a fireplace, and the entire room is hard to breathe in.
But what I wasn't prepared for is, like, I knew this movie was ostensibly a Western, and I've been very into Westerns lately, which was sort of the impetus to finally get around and cover this movie. But the movie starts at fucking Harvard University in 1870. And I immediately knew it wasn't Harvard, because I grew up around Boston. I've spent a lot of time around Harvard, and I'm like, that's not Harvard.
Right.
It's actually Oxford College in England. And it looked like Oxford College in England.
It was really confusing. It looked like they were in England. And then you see John Hurt speak, who's English. I'll let you describe our first images of John Hurt and Kris Kristofferson.
It is just absurd because we are supposed to believe that 40-something Kris Kristofferson, who looks like he's in his 40s. He's not a young-looking 40-something.
His face is cracked as shit. His eyes are deep and sunken.
Yeah, they've shaved his beard, and they think that's going to do the trick to make him look younger. And it's like, no.
It's really confusing. What we're supposed to be watching is recent college grads at their graduation ceremony.
Yeah, like getting into college hijinks and running around.
They've got him in these stupid, like, page boy hair cuts that look ridiculous. It looks like they're wearing some kind of Halloween costume. And both John Hurt and Kris Kristofferson are supposed to be like 19 years old or 18.
John Hurt looks 50, easily 50. And this is like the year after Alien.
It is the most confusing scene that I can remember in recent memory. They don't even try to make these guys, there's no makeup. They should have been different actors entirely.
Yeah, absolutely. They should have cast different actors to play them younger.
So we see these 40-something-year-old men trying to play teenagers, and then they're running around outside with hundreds of extras, getting drunk and drinking champagne, and it's supposed to be this, like, bon voyage, we'll see you down the road. I thought, like, great, we're going to see the span of time and watch these people grow because this is an epic. And also, I thought this is going to be about the relationship between these two characters.
I have a lot to say about this.
The setup is that these two characters, which are only focusing on these. I think the camera does look at a woman. There's a girl that they're interested in.
Yeah, who comes back in the most inexplicable way at the end of the friggin' movie.
Not Isabelle Huppert.
No.
It is not her.
She's just called the girlfriend. That's literally her character.
So it's these two quote-unquote young men graduating from college, and it's set up like it's going to be about their relationship and possibly this other woman.
Dude, there's this whole friggin' speech that John Hurt gets. He's like the class valedictorian or something, and he does this like wry poetic speech, which is supposed to be funny. This goes on for like friggin' 20 minutes.
Yes, it's at endless. Least.
And like, we're in a 3-hour and 40-minute movies. I'm thinking, am I watching a Western or not?
No, it seemed like it was going to be a buddy movie, and like something was going to happen dramatically between their relationship.
One of the major dramatic flaws of this movie, which would have been so easy to fix, and I don't know why they didn't do it, is so, yes, you're right. We're getting this establishing of this relationship of these two college friends, as ridiculous as it is, okay, at least we know that they were friends in college.
Yeah.
Now we're going to jump ahead 20 years to Wyoming, okay? Kris Kristofferson's character is
still way older than he should be for his character.
I have a real tough time just kind of getting a handle on what his character is, like what his job is.
Was he a marshal? Was
he supposedly a marshal? And I only know this because I read it in Wikipedia.
I was going to ask you this because I felt stupid. I could never figure out what he was exactly.
And here's another complaint I have about this movie is the sound friggin' sucks. Like, it clearly seems like Cimino insisted on taking all the sound from on-set recordings.
Yes.
Like, it's like the opposite of like a spaghetti Western.
It's very deliberate.
There's scenes where there's like wind blowing, and most movies, they will get like some kind of like artificial wind sound or a canned wind sound. But you can tell when you hear the wind in this that they really just stuck a mic outside in a windy day and it has that weird sound.
Well, there was that other scene where they were in the city. It's a big town, essentially, with brick buildings and stuff. But he was trying to get the ambiance of the traffic and the horses and the people, and you can't hear what the characters are saying.
No, you can't hear the dialogue.
So it was a deliberate choice.
It's like a fucking Christopher Nolan movie half the time where I'm like, so what am I supposed to know about this character or whatever? So we do eventually come back to the John Hurt character, and now he's like this drunk, and he's associated himself with these like ranchers. And the situation is Kris Kristofferson is the marshal of, I guess, Johnson County.
He shows up for some reason. Do you know why?
He's passing through at that moment. That scene with Richard Mazur, so one of your favorite actors from The Thing.
Clark from The Thing? Yeah.
Yes.
That's how I'm going to call him, is Clark from The Thing. He's playing an Irishman with a thick Irish accent in here.
Yeah, and he works at the train station in Casper, Wyoming. And this is based on the Johnson County War, which was an incident that happened in the late 1800s where cattle ranchers came into conflict with immigrants who had moved into the area. The situation was, or at least the way that the movie presents it, and this movie got into a lot of trouble for being historically inaccurate.
Yeah, it's very loosely based on this incident.
Which is so weird because I thought some of the choices made with the characters were based, because that's not how it went in real life. But no, this is all made up. The central conflict of this is that there's these immigrants who moved into the area. They're mostly European. I think they're supposed to be...
Okay, I tried to look into the internet for this and find out who these people were. It just says Europeans. There's never any kind of like association with a certain country. It seems like they all kind of have slightly different accents. Like it should be presented as a community of people from a specific place in which the homesteaders were in conflict with because they were from a certain place. But no, they're just simply kind of Europeans. In fact, these people are so two-dimensional that I honestly think they are even less realistic than the villagers in like a Frankenstein movie. They just seem like, you know, thick accented Eastern Europeans that are made up from like a Hollywood screenwriter in the 40s or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I noticed definitely there was Russian speaking and there was German speaking. Yeah. And at one point there seems to be like a conflict within their community between different nationalities. But even that was so poorly defined that I didn't really know what was going on.
It's distracting from the movie because you're trying to really figure out who these people are. And the film actually never really helps you with that. With the way that this plot is set up, it should be really about them.
Right.
But they're kind of background people. And it's not even really about the Stock Growers Association either.
No.
It's about Kris Kristofferson and this madam from a brothel.
Yes, and the love triangle he shares with sexy Christopher Walker.
Okay, let's just go back. We were talking about John Hurt, and we were talking about how this film was set up to be about these two pals.
The dramatic sort of positioning of this is going to be that Kris Kristofferson is this good guy who is sympathetic to these immigrants who are getting picked on by these cattle ranchers, right? What's happening is these poor immigrants are starving because they can't farm their land, and so they're killing the livestock that wanders onto their land, and that's pissing off the cattle ranchers because they, you know, they're illegally taking their cattle and killing them to eat them.
Yeah, they're stealing cattle. They're eating them and using them for trading.
So this is causing a major conflict. And so the big sort of like MacGuffin of this movie, the thing that's going to be sort of moving the conflict forward, is that the cattle ranchers are uniting and they've put together this list of 125 names that they can just go and kill. They can just go and murder these people, these immigrants. And we find that John Hurt's character is gotten involved with these people and he's become a drunk, but he's against them. Like he's voting against them. The villain is going to be Sam Waterston. He's the leader of this community. He was on Law and Order for years, so it's a little hard to see him as the villain.
He does look pretty smarmy in that, though, as a young man.
But what's so frustrating is like, this should obviously be John Hurt.
Right.
He should be the villain. It should be about these two old friends who are now in conflict because one's on the other side of this conflict. And it's like, yeah, they both come from privilege, but Kris Kristofferson is resisting that privilege and living amongst the people as a modest person, and his best buddy is now siding with these, you know, wealthy assholes, and they're going to kill a bunch of people.
100%. It should be about that, because John Hurt is already part of this community, and he's all his character does at that point for the rest of the film is get drunk and say how he kind of disagrees with what they're doing.
Right.
And they put him in the background and he's a nuisance. He's just a little bit annoying and they tell him to shut up. That's his character. We hardly see him any of the time. He doesn't move the story in any way at all.
Nope.
He is reduced to be a background character that's a drunk And that's it. He was the first character we saw in the movie with this great speech about altruism or something.
Right. And so, like, what do you do with that character? You turn it around so that in 20 years he's gone back on everything that he said on that speech. But no. And so this completely negates the need for that whole opening sequence.
Yeah. There's no reason
like,
for it.
Like, we could easily just roll into this movie at 20 years later in Wyoming. Oh, he knows John Hurt, but they're not really friends anymore. He's just going to be a background character or whatever. We don't need any of this setup. And apparently, this movie took so long to make that John Hurt went off and shot the Elephant Man and then came back and finished his scenes movie.
Well, he's kind of hardly in it. Like, it's amazing how much this character, who should be
central,
he's not in it for most of the movie. He shows up occasionally as a drunk, and they literally just tell him to shut up. And then he quiets up, and he goes, they'd like throw shit at him, and then he passes out.
Yeah, and John Hurt is an amazing actor, and no shade to Sam Waterston, but like, if you're going to choose Sam Waterston or John Hurt, who are you going to take?
Right.
Friggin' John Hurt.
Oh, and he would be an amazing villain in this movie.
It is such a baffling missed opportunity, and like, and I don't know what sort of drugs they were taking on set.
Cocaine. There's specifically cocaine. So I'm not making a joke about that. Cocaine was actually a huge problem during this era of Hollywood.
I'm sure.
So I reread this book called Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, which is a classic. Totally would recommend that to anybody. It's written as a tabloid. It is such a fun read for this era of Hollywood. But there's a passage in that where Robert Evans, famous producer, flew off to the set of Popeye and lost his luggage and had to call Henry Kissinger because he had so much cocaine in his luggage that they had to call somebody at a high up level to stop the FDA from searching his bags.
Wow.
Like, that's the level of cocaine that was running through the studios during this time.
I'm proud to say I've met Robert Evans.
Wow.
Yeah, he used to come into Cinephile all the time.
Oh, that's amazing.
So let's talk a little bit about this cast because it's pretty friggin' stacked.
Yeah.
Some of the faces that you will see in this movie, not that any of them matter that much, but we get Jeff Bridges as the character of Bridges, who is going to be like an entrepreneur type character in this town. We get Brad Dourif in a minor role. We get Terry O'Quinn, Jeffrey Lewis, who I'm a big fan of Jeffrey Lewis. He shows up as a weird trapper character. Mickey Rourke.
Young Mickey Rourke, looking great.
Yeah, looking really handsome.
Creepy Tom Newman. Noonan.
We'll talk about the Tom Noonan scene because that definitely merits more discussion. In a blink and you miss him cameo, you get Willem Dafoe in the background.
I missed him. Really?
I saw him and I was like, was that Willem Dafoe? And then I looked on Wiki and it's like, yeah, it's one of his first roles.
Oh, wow.
He doesn't speak or anything. He's just like in the background. He's one of the immigrants.
Now, after laying out that list, I would say that nobody in this movie of that stellar cast shined.
No.
Not one single performance. You could look at this film and say like, oh my God, Jeff Bridges in Heaven's Gate. Like, nobody. Everybody phoned this in, or it seemed to. It's probably that they were just dragged down by this production, but I would say out of all these incredible, all this incredible talent, I can't think of one person that stood out and was like, oh, that. But at least there's Christopher Walken. He's amazing. Like, no, nobody in this film.
Let's talk a little bit about Christopher Walken's character because he's so central to the story, but yet I really struggled to kind of get a real handle on him.
Again, who is he and what is he doing there? Like, this movie really has a problem with establishing its villains and its heroes and their relationships.
Well, I thought he was a villain at first.
They set him up as a villain.
Yeah, the first scene we see him, he's like murdering this immigrant who's stolen a cow and is like stripping it of its flesh, and he just kind of shows up and blows him away like through a sheet.
Yeah, you think this guy's going to be the enforcer. He's going to be the hand of the law that comes in and starts slaughtering all these Europeans, but he's not.
No, then like halfway through the movie, he shows up at the brothel where Kris Kristofferson hangs out with Isabelle Huppert, which that was also confusing. Like, I didn't really know what was going on there, because it's not like the sort of brothel you're used to seeing in a Western where it's like in the town, in the saloon or whatever.
It takes a while to figure out that it's a brothel at all.
You think he's just visiting his girlfriend or his wife at their home, because it's like this country home out in the middle of nowhere. And then you find out that there's all these other women living there. And I thought maybe they were her sisters or something like that. But no, she's a madam and this is a brothel. And Christopher Walken's character also visits this brothel. And so we're going to get this love triangle that's really the emotional center of the movie. And it does not work at all.
You see what just happened? We set it up with John Hurt. John Hurt disappears, introduce Christopher Walken, and now we have a love triangle, and we're not even focused on the cattle ranchers and the Europeans anymore.
Right.
Now we're spending all this time in a brothel with Christopher Walken, Isabelle Huppert, and Kris Kristofferson, and it's so confusing at this point that you're struggling to find out why you're here at all.
And like Christopher Walken is going to show up and we're going to realize that these two guys are actually friends.
Yeah.
And so we get this whole scene where Christopher Walken like drags Kris Kristofferson back to where he's living. And Kris Kristofferson is like living in the back of this like immigrant bunkhouse, just piled high with immigrants left and right, even though he's got money and could ostensibly afford to live somewhere.
It's trying to be that he's this big sympathizer, right? So he's living with them, but he does have this nice room in the back and everybody else is in these stacked in these bunks. He's the only one with actual private room.
But this is our introduction to them being friends, where one of them is passed out and the other has come to fuck his girlfriend.
Right.
But we're supposed to understand that these guys like got along or something. So this like
it's so weird
love triangle is going to tear them apart or something.
And it's just kind of randomly introduced into a movie that you're already struggling to. You're still trying to figure out why John Hurt's in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, and then it tells you this movie is about this conflict with these Europeans and these cattle ranchers. And then you got Christopher Walken.
And the arc for Christopher Walken's character and as regards to the plot is just going to be that he's going to turn against the cattle ranchers because they are going too far with this kill list or whatever.
I never understood. And there's no conversation in here which establishes anything about. Till the end of the movie, I had no idea what his intentions were. Christopher Walken's character. I never understood where he sided with. Did he love this woman? There's a conflict at the end. There's a big showdown. I never felt like I'm with him. I'm with this guy. He was in love with this woman. He's turning against them. You never feel that with his character.
Let's talk a little bit about this too, because this was another thing that I found really dramatically frustrating about this. So this triangulation of what they try to do here with these characters is this. So we've got Christopher Walken, who doesn't have any money, but he's trying to make a name for himself by working with these cattle ranchers, right? He lives in this weird shack with like Mickey Rourke and Jeffrey Lewis.
See, I never even understood what that place was.
That's where he lived because like his bed was there.
Okay. I never got that because there's a scene where he invites Isabelle Huppert over.
Yeah.
And he's like, look what I've done for you. I put wallpaper up on this place. I thought he had built that place for her or something. And I didn't know why these other dudes were hanging out with him. I never understood anything that was going on in that shack.
I think what we're supposed to take from that is that those are the kind of people those are his class that he's really trying to get out of. Weird fur trappers. And like the wallpaper, quote unquote, is just like playbills that he's taken from places and plastered them on the wall. And he's trying to, you know, show Isabelle Huppert that he can create a life for her, I guess, is what the scene is supposed to be. But meanwhile, Kris Kristofferson actually has money, right? And we're supposed to be thinking of Isabelle Huppert as somebody who's pragmatic and is going to do whatever like makes sense for her life, right? But for some reason, the movie tells us that she's going to choose to go with Christopher Walken because he like proposes marriage to her, and Kris Kristofferson won't propose marriage to her. Right. But Kris Kristofferson is trying to get her out of town because what we didn't mention is she's an immigrant, and we're going to find out that she's on this kill list. So Kris Kristofferson wants her to leave, and he's like, leave with me. But she's like, no, I love Christopher Walken. Even though she makes Christopher Walken pay for sex, and she doesn't make Kris Kristofferson pay for sex.
It's so weird. And she's ultimately supposed to be the voice of the immigrants.
Yes.
Right? She should be the spokesperson for what their plight is. And she's really kind of disconnected from them. She lives in this house. They live in a bunk like miles away. She has this business. They don't. Like, she's not starving. Her relationship is kind of weird because they actually pay for sex by bringing the stolen cattle. And she's got like a field in the back with like 20 steers or something that are all stolen that immigrants have paid to come to the brothel and pay for.
Well, that's why she's on the list, is because she accepts stolen cattle as payment.
Yeah. But she is also one of these immigrants. So it's really bizarre because her character really should be the one saying, these are my people and I need your help because of, I need your help, Christopher Walken and Kris Kristofferson.
Right. Exactly.
Right. And she never does that. She's just like, maybe I can't decide who to marry.
Yes.
That's all her character is.
Well, no, it's not even I can't decide who to marry. It's like, well, this one guy proposed, so I guess I'll go with him. Kris Kristofferson is too 70s manly man to not just propose marriage or something. Like, I don't even understand why he's reticent to just be like, well, marry me.
Right.
Like, it's like a 70s guy thing or something. Like, I gotta be free, baby, or whatever. I'm Kris Kristofferson. I can't ask a woman to marry me.
You know, I was wondering about that. Like, what did Kris Kristofferson go on to do after this? Because I feel like if he went down with the studio system, if the 70s man also was done after this.
He did kind of get guilt by association with this. I don't think he got many leading roles after this. And he was kind of a big 70s leading man.
Yeah, he was a big deal. It was like your Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
Tough, you know, manly man, hairy, sweaty 70s guy.
But to your point, like, her relationship with the rest of the immigrants is really weird because, like, the only real scenes we get where she's interacting with the town are first, Kris Kristofferson gifts her like a horse and buggy, and we get this weird scene where she like goes on a crazy riding spree through the center of town on her horse and buggy while they're trying to have some sort of meeting or something. And then, so this movie is called Heaven's Gate, right? And this is just the craziest thing to me. The title comes from a roller rink that Jeff Bridges' character has built in the center of town where they have most of their meetings.
Yeah. It's kind of a grange hall. It's like where they have music and events. It's a big, spacious building where they can have events, essentially.
And so we get this like 20-minute scene, which, you know, Cimino thinks is going to be his like Godfather wedding scene or whatever. Like, I knew as soon as this scene started, I'm like, oh, I know this is going to go on forever. Where we're like following this roller skating fiddler, right?
Yeah.
And he's like fiddling in like a circle in this fucking Heaven's Gate roller rink. And then all the people, including Kris Kristofferson and Isabelle Huppert, start to like square dance or whatever.
With roller skates on,
right? And you also have to keep in mind, like, this was the fad at this time in the 70s, was like roller discos
right.
and shit.
This is mirroring disco, right?
Right. Like, I highly doubt, I could be wrong, but I highly doubt, like, this was a real thing at the time. I mean, I'm sure roller skates existed, but like a roller rink somewhere in the Old West, it just seems like a bizarre.
Yeah, it's a 70s fantasy for sure.
Yeah.
But you're right, because this was like his Godfather wedding scene, because the only clips I've ever seen of this movie are this scene. And when you look at it in a book of like the history of film, you know, it shows like maybe some sprawling mountains, but you see these people on these roller skates. So this was supposed to be like that huge moment, like the one that everybody was going to talk about, that scene where you have 100 people on roller skates And yeah. ultimately, you're just waiting for it to fucking get over.
Well, because nothing's happening. Yeah. All that it's supposed to be doing is showing us this great romance that Kris Kristofferson and Isabelle Huppert are experiencing. And, you know, so this whole, like, roller rink fiddle party square dance thing is happening, and they're dancing together. And then the scene goes on where they are just there alone, and the musicians are playing, and they're dancing together. Like, why on earth do we need that addendum to it? Everything in this movie is just three times as long as it needs to be.
Right.
And I know I'm, like, approaching this with a modern sensibility, you know.
No, you're not. Let's compare it to the wedding scene in The Godfather. In that scene, there was a lot of information that was conveyed. You had the opulence of that family, as well as individual conversations about what was happening within the family. There was a lot of exposition.
Yes.
You're getting kind of another vacuum with this roller skating scene. There shouldn't be any opulence. These people are super poor. You're trying to get a sense of a community, but the immigrants have no voice in this. And it's only focusing on Kris Kristofferson and Jeff Bridges and this love, you know, not even the love triangle, but you're getting random bits of information about. You're not getting any information. Can you pull anything that you got out of that scene that gave you any kind of plot-driven information?
No, nothing plot-driven, because everything that's gone on with the Jeff Bridges character is done in the cockfighting scene,
right,
where we get actual, like, cockfighting, which is not pleasant to watch, and I'm sure was something that
was real.
Yeah, was real, and they got in trouble for. So, like, that's all been handled. Like, we know everything we need to know. This is all just to establish their love story, which isn't even really going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all of this just feels sort of useless. Like, it's pretty to look at.
And that's it. This is, like, a shining example of what the film really was all about, was, like, how much money can we spend on every single shot,
yeah. you know?
Every single shot looks gorgeous, and it's filled with extras and choreography. Like, you know, arguably, it's nice to see all these people in costumes roller skating around in circles with their flowing cloaks. And you've got this, you know, wood burning stove in the middle of it and smoke pouring out into the mountains from the Heaven's Gate building. You've got horses outside. I mean, there's even one scene, this isn't the same scene, but there's one scene where they're inside one of these buildings, they're talking, and outside there's like a juggler in the background. Like,
right.
They're yeah. just cramming all this, you know, imagery into these scenes with nothing happening, with none of the dialogue you should be getting. It's purely visual, and it's just eye candy. The whole movie is like that.
I mean, it's nice to see these sort of settings and scenes that you don't find typically in Westerns. Like, it does feel like it's charting territory that you haven't seen before, which I can appreciate about
it's
it.
Shot in Montana. It's like this location is beautiful.
Yeah.
Every time they shoot the mountains, you're just wondering, like, how did they get a whole film crew out here?
But to your point, like, so many scenes, you don't really even understand what dramatically is happening. Like, the Richard Mazur character,
Clark from the Thing
is going to end up getting shot on one of these hillsides that looks amazing. I mean, it looks like something out of Sound of Music. And I don't even understand why he's there. Like, he's seen them come into the train station, the group of mercenaries, basically, that's going to go and kill all of these immigrants. And then he runs off to this hillside and just gets shot.
I guess he found out that he was on the list, but that was confusing too, because he's clearly Irish from his bad accent that he's doing. And all the other people seem Eastern European. I never associated him with this other community. And that was another problem with the film, is it didn't really establish who the community was.
Yeah.
Besides, they all just seem like background extras.
Well, they try to. There's a scene with Brad Dourif where he's trying to settle some sort of disagreement or something that's going on, or they're arguing about what they're going to do when these ranchers, these mercenaries come in and start killing everybody. And like, Kris Kristofferson is reading off the names on the list, and like, pretty much everybody there is on the list.
Oh God, that scene, it seemed like it lasted an hour. There's a scene where they're at the Heaven's Gate and the roller, there's a different day or something. It's kind of a big meeting place. And he's like, There's a list, which has been established like an hour ago, right? He's like, there's a list. A lot of your names are on it. And they're like, who's on it? Whose names? Who's it? All right. You want me to do this? I'll do it. And he goes one at a time, like,
yeah,
Mikhail, Zygmunt.
And then we see a shot of somebody in the crowd going, oh.
Oh, God. Oh, no. And then there's a pause and there's a long, long beat. Everybody looks around at each other. And then he's like, Edwin. And then it shows like Edwin in the background. And he's like, no, it can't be. And they all look at each other. This scene goes on for like 15 or 20 names like that.
The word interminable can easily be applied to most of the scenes in this movie. But one scene that you couldn't apply that to is the gang rape with Tom Noonan that happens at the brothel.
Real quick, did Tom Noonan ever play a hero, or is he always just a creepy guy? I've always just seen him
as a
total creeper. He was Hannibal Lecter, right, in Manhunt?
No, he's the other serial killer in the story.
The Red Dragon or whatever?
Yes.
Okay.
He's usually a villain. He played a lovable Frankenstein in Monster Squad.
Oh, he was the Frankenstein in Monster Squad?
So not all bad.
All right. So he plays a monster or a rapist or a serial killer, but a lovable monster.
Yeah, this scene is pretty messed up because these three mercenary guys, including Tom Noonan, show up at the brothel. And it's frustrating because Isabelle Huppert has been warned multiple times at this point, like, your name is on the list. Get out of town. Freaking make up your mind. Either be with Christopher Walken or Kris Kristofferson.
And none of the other people have now. She has two handsome men that will whisk her away to safety.
Right. Like, what is she deliberating about at this point? I guess we're supposed to think that she's trying to protect her employees or whatever.
No, but there's never a scene where she's like, I can't leave because these are my people. Never. Right. Not once does she establish that, like, this is my home. I'm defending my home. This isn't right. She's just indecisive.
These dramatic beats are things that you think would just be there, like, at the beginning. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's almost as if he's intentionally avoiding these things. Like, did he think that these would be too cliche if he just hit these beats that need to be there? Because it just feels like avoidance at every turn. Okay, if she wants to stay, then she needs to explain why she's not leaving. Like, people are coming to murder her. Leave.
So Tom Noonan's gang that shows up, I was getting them confused with Christopher Walken's buddies. Are they totally different people?
Totally different.
Okay.
These are just scumbags who are working for the homesteaders.
They're part of the militia, but they're feeling they can also rape and pillage because these people have a death sentence anyways, right?
Yes. And we should say that this movie has a lot of nudity in it. I mean, Isabelle Huppert is nude a lot. A lot of other women are naked a lot. So, you know, if you're in it for the horniness, you might get something out of this. And Isabelle Huppert is quite beguiling in the movie. She's very pretty.
She's not just naked in the gang rape scene.
No, she's not naked at all in the gang rape
scene. She's not? Oh, that's right. Okay. The nakedness is like beautiful. You know, they're in a river, skinny dipping. It's a lovely, sunshiny 70s. You know, naked in the grass.
It's like European 70s softcore. Yeah. But yeah, this scene gets really ugly because basically these three dudes just gang rape her, and Christopher Walken's like running around on the roof at one point, and he finally comes in and shoots them.
Well, that's the other thing about this scene, is it's trying to establish that he saves her, but he shows up way late, right?
Yeah.
Like, she's almost dead by the time he shows up. And then there's supposed to be this, like, he shows up in the window and he's sneaking, he slits a guy's throat and he makes his way on top of the roof and he's climbing around, but they're already done.
Right. Well, yeah, just bust in and start shooting. Why is he creeping around like a ninja?
He's like sneaking around trying to be really silent to make a ninja entry.
Right. Like, just go in the front door.
And it's taking forever. Like, and he can see that she's like at death's grip inside, and these guys they're gonna finish it off by killing her, and he's taking his sweet time with this hero act of saving her, and he finally does blow him away, but like 5 minutes way too late in screen time.
He's a frustrating hero like this multiple times in the movie, because in the climax, you're waiting for him to come around and like join the fight, join the rebellion or whatever. And he does, but like a whole huge battle goes on without his involvement, where he's just kind of like, I don't know, begrudgingly staying out of it.
He's also drunk most of the movie too. So I couldn't quite get if they were trying to make his character a frustrated drunk, because most of the time people are trying to wake him up from a drunken stupor in the mornings and they're slapping him, trying to wake him up. And like,
yeah,
he's supposed to have this big drinking problem, but it's not really addressed. Like once he's awake, he's like, I'm going to have my coffee and save all y'all.
There is one scene near the end where they come and rouse him out of bed and he's gotten really drunk with Jeff Bridges the night before.
Yeah.
And he does seem like really hungover. He keeps like looking under the bed, trying to find his boot because he's so hungover. And they're like, help us. What are you going to do? Like, they're coming. Like, it's the immigrants all freaking out. And he's like, he can't even find his boot. He's so messed up.
Is that a problem or is it a tough guy thing? Like, is he a tough guy drunk or is he a problematic drunk that's going to fail?
Totally not clear. Like, it's the dramatic beats are all weird and wrong.
Yeah.
We've already established the drunk guy. Is
John Hurt.
John Hurt.
Who's long forgotten. At this point, John Hurt is out of the movie. Like, he's not part of the movie anymore.
We do get a pretty epic climax to the movie.
The progression of this movie, it started off, I thought, I might love this movie just based on the visuals and the sprawling locations. And then 40 minutes into it, I decided this movie's a shitty movie. Nothing's gelling. Like you said, none of the dramatic beats are happening. Nothing's getting established. This is a mess. Then after the intermission, we see Clark from The Thing get shot and things start to pick up.
The plot kicks in, basically.
Plot kicks in and this is leading up to a battle. And it takes a long ass time to get to the battle, to the whole second part of it. You know, there's another 2 hours or something, or an hour and a half. But we do get to this battle. You can tell it's leading up to this because if you read anything about the movie, it's based on this quote-unquote war that happened.
We do have a scene where Christopher Walken is killed in a shootout in a shack.
I forget about that scene because, again, totally confused as to what Christopher Walken was doing and why he got shot.
Well, he's basically taken a stand against them because they're going to try to kill Ella.
Kind of. He didn't really take a stand against the immigrants. He just is in love with the madam of the brothel.
Right. Like, he hasn't gone to the immigrants and been like, I'm on your side now.
No, he never
Let's fight these guys. It's just kind of like he gets into an argument with Sam Waterston. And then now he's got to die with the rest of them. But we get a shootout at his creepy cabin where Mickey Rourke gets killed. And they like light his cabin on fire and he runs out and gets like shot in a hail of glory.
Can I ask really quick, did Christopher Walken just look like this in the late 70s? Because he looks like he's wearing a huge amount of eyeshadow. He kind of has this like strange, ambiguous, I can't really tell what gender he is. Like, he looks so strange in this movie. Did they put makeup on him or something? Or is that just what Christopher Walken looked like?
Well, I think for a hot minute there, they thought Christopher Walken was going to be like a sex symbol. Like, I think after the Deer Hunter, he was considered to be kind of like a suave leading man. I mean, Jen saw him in this movie and she was like, Christopher Walken's looking good.
Okay. The outfit he's wearing is this really nice suit that nobody else has any. Kris Kristofferson kind of has nice clothes in this, but Christopher Walken is decked out. He's wearing like a tie. He's really trim. You could almost see like a late era David Bowie look to him.
Totally. Yeah. He looks kind of like the Thin White Duke era of David Bowie.
Yeah.
I mean, he's supposed to be one of the romantic leads.
Weird.
It's not fair to him because Christopher Walken has come to mean something much different than that over the last 30 years. But, you know, at this time, he would have been considered a handsome leaning man kind of guy. Like, ooh, is she going to go with Kristofferson or Christopher Walken?
Yeah, I think that's just adding to my confusion as to which direction this movie's headed in.
He's the Jacob to Kristofferson's Edward here in the Twilight love triangle in this movie.
Yeah, anyways, there's a shootout at Christopher Walken's creepy house and they're going to move right on to Kris Kristofferson next.
But Kris Kristofferson is sitting it out. He's like, no, I'm not going to fight. Like, Ella goes to him and she's like, Christopher Walken is dead. I can be with you now. And in typical 70s guys fashion, Christofferson's like, no, you didn't choose me first, so screw you, or whatever. I don't even know what he says to her. And so she's like, well, fine, then I'm going to go fight without you. And so now she's like riding around in her buggy that he bought her and like shooting people. Like, suddenly she's this kind of badass who, like, can blow people away and stuff. I mean, not that I mind. I'm happy that shit's happening at this point. Like, I don't care what's going on.
People are on horses.
Right. There's some pretty cool battling going on here for, like, Western movie standards.
Yeah, it's kind of bloody.
You know, at one point, like, the cavalry comes and, like, surrounds them in a circle and everything. When Kris Kristofferson finally gets involved, because what happens is, the immigrants at first don't want to fight or defend themselves, and that frustrates Kris Kristofferson, but they do sort of put up a fight, but then he kind of Han Solos it, I guess, and eventually decides to come in and join the battle. And when he does, there's these cool moments where he kind of gets them to use these like Roman battle techniques.
They had to build that the night before, so that's what's confusing about his role. Like, he had this plan because he's educated.
Yes.
He went to college. That's as we saw in the beginning of the movie. He comes from a privileged upbringing and he's educated.
There's no way to get that information across if we don't have a 20-minute sequence in the beginning of the movie.
So he knows about Roman history and he figures they can build these shields. And Sam Waterston even goes, oh my God, they're using the Roman strategy. Like,
yes.
You know, so all the. educated homesteaders are aware of this, whatever Roman device that they've built, where it's like they take a cart and put a shield on the front of it with logs.
Yeah.
They build like four of these things, and it's kind of cool. They slowly move these in to the center circle of where the homesteaders are caught in the middle of the battle.
Yeah, they're like pinning them down. They're pinning them down in the center of the battlefield. I mean, it's cool. I've never seen that in a Western before, or even a Roman gladiator movie before. So, you know, I'm appreciating what I can here.
I mean, yeah, I get what you're saying. But for a movie that cost this much money, it should have been Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
It should have been the most memorable battle scene in cinema history.
You know they were thinking Lawrence of Arabia, too.
Right.
You know that's what they wanted this to be. Well, I do like, though, that the way the battle ends is the cavalry shows up. And in most movies, when the cavalry shows up, that means the good guys are going to be saved. But in this case, the cavalry represents the government. And we should say that, like, Sam Waterston has supposedly gotten permission from, like, the governor to kill
the president.
Well, yeah, the president, we find out.
He keeps saying, I got permission from the written letter from the president saying this is okay.
So in this case, the cavalry's coming to actually save the bad guys. And they sort of circle around the bad guys and they tell the immigrants that, the fight is over and everybody should just go home. Kris Kristofferson's there and he's just like, you're just saving them or whatever. So it's a nice sort of ironic twist on the usual cavalry trope. And it's, you know, in true depressing 70s fashion. So depressing, in fact, that this like woman character that's just seen her husband get killed, like blows her own brains out.
Oh, yeah.
Like, right there up against a wagon wheel. Kind of a, you know, unnecessarily depressing and brutal shot that I appreciated.
I liked the one where the guy gets run over by the giant wagon wheel and crushes his legs. And then he says, my legs are broken. I can't fight. That was pretty good.
There's fun stuff in here. I mean, I'm smiling at this point. Like, this is what I'm here for. Some brutality, a really depressing 70s ending. And to make it even worse, so after this battle is over, Kris Kristofferson and Isabel Huppert, Ella, are together and they're going to go off and leave and have a nice life together. And it's those two and Jeff Bridges going to leave her cabin or whatever. And then Sam Waterston and his goons just show up and like blow them away, or blows Isabel Huppert and Jeff Bridges away, leaving Kristofferson alive. He shoots Waterston dead. We get this sort of pained scene of Christofferson like going like, no.
Basically, everybody dies at the end of this movie.
Except Christofferson.
Oh, and we forgot John Hurt did come in at the in that battle briefly.
To get shot.
Drunk. He's just sitting there drinking out of his flask, looking around going, oh, dear Lord.
This is terrible what we're doing here. Oh, it's just dreadful.
That's what this character amounted to. That we, the first character we saw giving this grand speech in the beginning of the movie, just stands on the battlefield with his flask going, oh, no, no, no.
And they keep cutting to him throughout that whole first battle.
And then he gets shot and he just dies.
Yeah, the end. That's the end of his character. What an arc.
Christofferson didn't even see his friend die, his college buddy that we say. They don't even see each other in this battle.
What was the thinking there?
His college friend just got mowed down in the battle, and Chris Christofferson isn't even aware of it. And it's never even mentioned. It's so bizarre.
This is what should be the movie.
I just can't even believe there wasn't even a cut to Chris Christofferson seeing John Hurt get killed. Like,
yeah,
that would have been the very least you could have done to tie their relationship together. Like, just a reaction shot. Like, oh God, my college friend, he's dead. Like, nothing.
Nope.
He's not even in the same vicinity as him.
Yeah, I'm sure they weren't even there on the set the same day. Chris Christofferson was jamming with Jeff Bridges in his trailer.
Right.
They apparently jammed a lot on the set of this
movie. Oh, that's class. That's so great.
As they waited to go on to the set. So yeah, that's the sort of end, except we get this awful, awful like epilogue scene that takes place I don't know how many years later.
Oh God, I forgot all about this. I totally forgot about this.
Where Chris Christofferson is on a yacht off the shore of Rhode Island.
And it's a horrible visual effect where he's shot on like an early 80s blue screen.
Yes.
Against the backdrop of the ocean. And he's on this... Yeah, this weird...
Well, it's supposed to be a yacht, but it looks like a fishing boat or something.
It's
like the exterior is not a yacht. It's a boat. But then he goes inside the boat and it's like he's got like this fancy parlor room.
With a fireplace. He has a fireplace in his cabin.
And the girlfriend from the beginning of the movie is there.
I totally forgot about this.
They have this bad old age makeup on both of them. He's had this picture of them when they were young that we've seen throughout the movie, which makes no friggin' sense, because when you're seeing it in the context of the movie, you think, oh, did they get married and did she die or something? And that's why he's with Isabelle Huppert. No, apparently he just kept this picture of his college sweetheart who he didn't marry back then, and now has come back around and they've reconnected, I guess.
This scene, as you're describing it, I had completely forgotten about it. And now I'm only realizing that I think I finished the movie and thought that was a weird dream I had about the movie. Because this scene makes no sense in the context of the film. None.
You cannot make sense of it. You're like, what happened? Like, okay, so now he's back with his college girlfriend who like... You probably have forgotten was even in the movie at this point.
You've totally forgotten about, because I did. I'd forgotten who this, when this scene happened, I did not know who that woman was. I just thought it was some new woman. Like he's gone off, forgotten his past and moved on to something else. He's rich. I don't know what that scene was about. So it's his old college heartthrob. Like,
and she like is lying on this like recliner or whatever and like asks him for a cigarette,
and even when he lights it he's like struggling to reach her. It's the most bizarre choreographed scene. Yeah, that scene is so weird.
It's just baffling. Like, why is this the final scene in the movie? It makes no sense at all. And this is what you're going to send people out of the theater with.
If they've made it that far.
This giant question mark. Like, huh?
Yeah. It should have just ended on its depressing 70s ending where everybody dies. But
that was the thing to do at the time, right? Yeah. Like, that's how you end your movie in the 70s.
You think they got away, but they actually get shot. Roll credits. To sum it up, I actually love this era of American filmmaking. I think it's the best era because of the problems that were happening. Like the amount of money that was being poured into singular visions at this time. and that they were trying to be a little bit more artsy, and the studios were backing it. I love most of the movies that, and I love all the failures too. Like, and I love the weird attempts at science fiction where they couldn't quite figure out the template yet with what Star Wars basically was, it was going to be from that point on. But this movie was none of those things. Like I said, when I began it, I thought, oh, this is going to be another big failure. I'm going to probably love most of it. I'm going to at least like seeing some of the, these performances in here. But everything about this movie was a failure, except for like the beautiful cinematography.
I mean, I think that if you really love Westerns and you want to see something kind of epic with lush cinematography and a big, expensive production, it might be worth watching, for at least for a little bit of it. I won't get into why did it fail, because I think we've covered why it failed.
Yeah.
The budget was $44 million, so four times what it was originally budgeted at, and it only made 3.5. That is a huge loss.
A colossal failure.
The one thing I did want to bring up is the reappreciation of this film.
Which I don't get. So I was reading about that, and apparently like people have forgiven it and actually found that it's a worthy addition to be put on one of the best American films ever made list. And I don't get that. I don't understand that.
Criterion has released it on Blu-ray. And, you know, I mean, not that Criterion hasn't released some stinkers,
yeah,
but, you know, I mean, that label on it is, you know, giving it some sort of prestige. And, you know, I don't think this movie needs to be hated upon or anything. Like, I don't think it should be the laughing stock of cinema forever. I think there's some, you know, things about it that are commendable. But a reappreciation, I think, seems to me a bit of a miscalculation.
Yeah. You know, a study of it. And I'm assuming that that's probably more what Criterion was interested in when they made a Blu-ray of this, is a study.
I mean, it's historically significant. Like, it is historically significant. I'll give it that, you know, and what a lush and lavish production it is. It's, you know, worthy of note. And, you know, at this point, who cares that it lost a bunch of money? I mean, who gives a shit?
Well, but the main significance is it was a huge shift in the way that movies were produced after this film.
Well, I guess here's my question for you then, is if Heaven's Gate hadn't been released, some other movie would have been, right?
Well, that's what I was reading about, is that Heaven's Gate was the scapegoat. It was saying this could have been Sorcerer. It could have been one of these other films. That it could have been Popeye. Even Raging Bull, they were saying, like, what was happening with the director-driven visionary cinema of the time was already showing itself to be a huge problem. You were getting successes like Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
But, you know, even Disney was guilty of pouring money into, this is their worst era. Like, the Black Hole was a giant failure at this time with tons of money put into it. So Heaven's Gate, it was just because it was like the most expensive movie and it failed so poorly. But it could have been another film that had made the decisions to shut down the party.
Right.
You know, to put this whole system to a stop and these blank checks. Basically what happened is the studios kind of collectively restructured. Executives now were making the decisions, not the directors, and it had to be bankable. Enter the 80s. And then sequels. And you can see where the money was put immediately after this.
And now we're living in the world where IP-driven big-budget movies are the whole system now.
Yeah, that's the system. And just to reiterate that, like, we're talking about a studio money, because you're always going to get your independence. Or like, you know, James Cameron can put his own money into a movie and whatnot. You can still get huge, expensive Christopher Nolan movies, but those are financed differently, or there's some other factor that's working to make those happen. We're talking about studio movies. So we're talking about, like, now we're living in the Marvel Disney era where you can put in $250 million to a movie, but it's a franchise. It's bankable. They know the numbers and they know what it's going to make.
Yeah.
Not that some of them still don't fail. Of course they do, but it's the studio money and where that's been channeled. It used to be channeled into movies like The Godfather, and that ended.
Yeah, I mean, and it's too bad because I do sort of miss movies like this. I understand why this couldn't continue, but at the same time, it is sort of sad that we don't get
prestige, giant, epic prestige movies.
I mean, I guess we still do, and they still fail, like that Babylon movie that just came out, apparently.
Yeah, so is that studio money?
Well, I feel like it's kind of the same cycle that always happens, where you get this sort of filmmaker that comes out of usually the indie scene, and then they have a few movies that are hits, and then they always end up making... They get their blank check movie, and it usually tanks.
Yeah. So I think they, especially for awards reasons, they'll pick their best picture movie. That's probably what's you're talking about, is the studio has one project and they're like, this is going to be our best picture. And if it loses money, it's fine because it'll win the Oscar.
They'll shell out for prestige.
But just one, and they've got 10 other Marvel films behind them, those types of movies to hold up the studio system.
Yeah, and that's the world we're living in now. You can blame it all on Heaven's Gate. All right, I'm going to go steal some cattle and attend a cockfight and dance with my prostitute sweetheart at a roller rink square dance. That about does it today for Tentpole Trauma. If you like what you heard, check out our social media presence on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look for Tentpole Trauma. That was easy, wasn't it? If you like us, hit subscribe and leave us a sterling review on iTunes, if you dare. If you really like us, head over to patreon.com and get involved in one of our fabulous tiers. You'll be glad you did. Want to communicate with Tentpole Trauma? Send an email to tentpoletrauma@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And who knows, one day you may even get your email read on one of our shows. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you real soon.